Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Today we have a great guest that I will introduce very shortly, but let's take a walk to the briefing room where I will give you my view from the blue.
The briefing room, headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
I'm going to dedicate this show today, and I'm going to dedicate it based on many of the events that have taken place of late with the murders of law enforcement officers, with the loss of these officers, and the guest that I have on, because it's all going to coincide. I'm going to dedicate this to the survivors, to the mothers and the fathers of those who have given their lives in the line of duty, to the wives and the husbands, and to the children who've given as much of a sacrifice as the officers who gave their lives. You know, in my capacity as a police officer, I've seen many of my comrades fall, some in the line of duty, some in other manners, but it's their service that counts. It's the way we remember them that counts. And the survivors, it is they who these memories live through. And it is they who make those officers live on. Because even though they have given their lives, they live on through the hearts and the minds of those that love them. I had a conversation with a mother of a law enforcement officer who was killed in the line of duty very recently. She reached out because of simply our connection from Facebook, of all things. And we had a long, long conversation about her son. And while there were tears shed by both of us, there was also a deep, deep pride in what her son had accomplished with his life. And I think that that is probably what makes the sacrifice of what her son gave, I think that that is what all survivors feel. Is that sense of pride that their loved one passed away doing something that was so meaningful to this country, so meaningful to their communities. Could any of us ask for a better legacy than be remembered for the contribution that we made to this world, to our society, to our communities? I don't think so. But to the families of those who have fallen, to those mothers, to those fathers, and the children and the spouses, I say this. Your sacrifice will never be forgotten, as your loved one will never be. And that is my view from the blue. Hello, this is Randy Sutton at Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, and we are in the interview room with the director, executive director of Concerns of Police Survivors, Diane Bernhard. And Diane has a very interesting biography, and she's perfectly suited for this particular assignment at this particular time in her career, as she is a retired police officer and deputy chief from the Columbia, Missouri Police Department. And in reading your bio, Diane, first of all, I want to welcome you to Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. Thanks for coming.
Thank you very much for having me. It's quite an honor.
You know, I saw in your bio that the way that you were introduced to COPS, the Concerns of Police Survivors, was from a very personal experience. Would you mind explaining that?
Absolutely. In 2005, I was still working as a police officer, actually a police sergeant in the Columbia, Missouri Police Department, and a coworker of mine and a very close friend was working in the evenings, and she stopped a car for you know, we never say it's a routine traffic stop, but it was a fairly routine traffic stop for speeding. And when she went up to the car, the single person that was in the car, a young man, stepped out of the car and shot her without any defense. She had no defense. And when she was shot in a way that she was paralyzed and wasn't able to fight back. She was lucky enough that there was a medical person that got there fairly quick, and she got every medical intervention that she could get. But unfortunately, 30 days later, she did succumb to her injuries, and she died. And our department wasn't exactly prepared for that. We had never had a line-of-duty death before, and it was a real challenge to us and a challenge to, obviously, a huge challenge to her family. And I came to know of COPS through Molly's family because, believe it or not, even though COPS has been around for 32 years, in 2005, I had never heard of COPS. But COPS was able to come in, and they came in and helped Molly's families in ways that our agency wasn't unable to. I mean, obviously, you know, being a medium-sized police department, we did a great job with the funeral and the initial response to her death. But the long-term effects of one of these deaths is something that we were not prepared for at all. I wasn't prepared for that. And so what COPS did is COPS came in and helped her family. And her dad would tell you that without COPS, he credits COPS with saving his life. Because it was just such a tough situation. My friend was 26 years old when she was shot and killed. She was she was married to a police officer in our same agency, and she had two stepchildren, two boys, and she had a mom and a dad and a brother, and their lives were forever changed by that, as well as all the officers that worked in our department.
So when you were introduced to COPS, that was fairly early on in your career. You were a sergeant then.
I was about 15 years into my career.
Right. So clearly it had a lasting impact on your life. And then how did you wind up in the position as the executive director?
Well, I was actually at the ending part of my career. It was time for me to consider retiring, and I was considering police chief jobs. And as I was doing that search, I stumbled upon the job opening at COPS. And I came down and I met with the founder of COPS, Ms. Susie Sawyer, who's an amazing individual and somebody you can never tell no to, ever. And we had a conversation about COPS, and I got to know some of the staff, and I got to research even more about the organization. And as I left that day, I knew that that's what I was going to be doing as my career after law enforcement. So it was quite an honor to actually, it's a privilege, actually, to work among the survivors that I work with and to be able to give back a little bit to the profession that's been so good to me throughout my career.
I think that, you know, when you think about the pathways of our lives, that you were looking for a police chief job, and I think without a shadow of a doubt, you could make such a greater impact on law enforcement and the people that you have come to know and love in the profession, in the position that you're in now.
No, you know, absolutely. I don't have any desire at this point to go a different direction. It's allowed me to keep that contact with the law enforcement culture, which I absolutely love. I grew up in it. And it lets me have that contact with Molly, my friend's parents still, and with the other families that experienced a loss, and it just adds meaning to your life. It really does.
I admire you. I admired you taking that pathway. Now, just as you didn't, even though you were an active duty law enforcement for 15 years, you were unaware of what COPS would do when that line of duty death happened to your friend. So let's take my listeners, who many of whom probably do not know about COPS. Let's explain what COPS is, what COPS does, and take the conversation that way.
Absolutely. Well, COPS, as I just had said, has been around for about 32 years. And what we'll do is, when there is a line of duty death, we have 53 chapters across the country. We're not in every state, but we're close. And we have some states that have a large number of line of duty deaths, and we actually have more chapters in those states because of that. So Florida, Texas, California, they all have more than one chapter. But what we'll do is, when there's a line of duty death, we'll actually have volunteer survivors. These are moms and dads, spouses, sometimes adult children of officers that were previously killed in the line of duty, and they volunteer and they actually respond and they will help that family as early as before the funeral, but they will stay as long as needed with a family. And when I say stay, I don't mean stay at their house. I mean they'll stay in contact and they'll act as a resource for them because they have walked in similar shoes.
Right.
And so there's just something unique about a law enforcement death versus a death from a car accident or something, you know, different that's also unexpected, because the law enforcement death is a very public event, and that's very different for our survivors. And if you haven't been through that, it's very difficult to understand how that completely takes your life and overturns it. And with these group of survivors that will come in and help, they've actually been there, done that. And so they're able to talk with that family through what it's like to go through a very public funeral, what it's like to lose that contact to law enforcement that was so much a part of your life. You know, 10 years down the road, you may not be as connected to that agency anymore. They know what it's like to go to the grocery store and have everybody there know what's happened to your family. And sometimes out of the goodness in their heart will make comments that don't sit well with you just because the person doesn't know what to say. Right. Everybody looks at them differently. And so it's very helpful for them to have a connection. It's just a peer support with somebody that's been there, done that. And it's just magical when you watch it work.
I have been in place where I have seen it work. And I've always been very impressed with the caliber of the people that volunteer for your organization. They do so out of a feeling of warmth and of love, and it's pretty amazing to see.
It is amazing to see, and it'll go on as long as that survivor needs us. So after the funeral is over and after the media attention dies down, is left with a life that they now have to recreate, because it's obviously missing a big piece of their family. We'll step in and do some certain things for that family. We'll help them apply for the benefits that are due to them because of the death.
Okay, let me stop you right there, because
sure.
this is a really important aspect here. Many do not realize, do not understand that there are certain benefits that that are available to them in the event of a line of duty death of a law enforcement officer. Would you just care to explain that just for a second before we move on from there?
Absolutely. For all public safety officers, for police and fire, if they experience a death in the line of duty, there is a public safety officer benefit program that's administered through the Department of Justice. And the family and the agency together apply for that benefit for that family. And that's reviewed through a process in Washington, D.C. And then if that family is awarded that benefit, there's a payment to that family from the PSOB, which is based on a cost of living. So it goes up a little bit each year that there's a cost of living increase. Right now that benefit's $339,000.
Right. And of course, that sounds like a large amount of money when you just take that figure. Wow, $339,000. But I mean, when you're talking about the loss of your husband or your wife the breadwinner of the family, that money doesn't last very long.
It absolutely does not. It's a small token that the federal government gives to that family, but you're right, it doesn't go that far. And there are other benefits available through state, individual states. Their benefits are all different. So we will help them navigate that process. You know, there's different things that they can apply for.
Right.
But at the same time, it's never enough, and the same thing is it doesn't bring back their loved one, and it doesn't help them with their grief necessarily. It sometimes helps pay those immediate bills, but it doesn't help with their grief. So that's where we step in. From there, we'll take the family, and we have what we call our hands-on programs, and these programs are all free to survivors. We don't ever charge a survivor for any of our programs. And so what we do is we invite those survivors to come. We generally do it in some sort of a rural location. Most of our programs are either in rural Missouri, Arkansas, or Wisconsin. But we invite those families. We put the spouses with other spouses at a retreat for the weekend, and we bring in counselors that are specifically trained in law enforcement culture and in loss and grief. And they have that opportunity to interact with each other, have a counselor present, and then also do some fun activities, and they're able to be in a safe environment where they can act a little silly and they won't be judged by the community that's, you know, that may be judging them because they had just lost their loved one. And many of them learn to smile again for the first time at those hands-on programs. But we do that for every survivor type. So we'll do those for spouses, we'll do those for parents. Just next week, I'll be heading to Wisconsin for the kids camp. And that's the camp that we bring kids together, ages 6 to 14. And amazingly enough, that peer support starts at age 6 in our program. It's amazing to watch it work.
I can imagine it's amazing. Now, how long is that kids camp?
It's a week long.
Great. Right. Yeah. I can imagine there's some incredible transitions that take place during those type of encounters at a week-long camp like that with those children.
Absolutely. And, you know, I talked earlier about how we're there for them as long as they need us. And some of these kids that will come to camp, they don't remember their officer parent that died. Some of them weren't even born yet when their officer parent died. So they're very unique. And when they come together and they meet another kid who didn't know his dad or didn't know his mom, and they start talking, it's kind of amazing. If you want to bear with me, I'm going to tell you just a real brief story from camp last year. I was walking with a six-year-old boy from, he had just finished his counseling session, and they were walking to lunch, actually. And I asked him, I said, "How do you like kids camp so far?" And he told me, "I love kids camp." And I said, "What do you like best about kids camp?" And he turned to me and he said, "I like it because here I'm just like everyone else. Here everybody's dad died." And it was one of those stop you moments and made me sit back on my heels a little bit. And I thought about that, and I thought that's the beauty of why COPS works. It's the beauty of, even at a six-year-old level, they're getting something out of this peer support. And it was just an amazing moment for me, a very sad moment for me as well.
Literally out of the mouths of babes.
Out of the mouths of babes, absolutely.
That's incredible. So, and you said you do the similar camps for adults, for the adults as well?
Oh, we do. Yes, we have the parents' retreat is a life-saving retreat, in my opinion. When a parent loses a child, you always know it's in the wrong order, but it's so unique to those parents that have lost their law enforcement child, and we bring together a large number of parents from across the country. We also do one for the siblings of police officers that are killed. They're often our forgotten survivors.
Right.
The siblings will all come and take care of that surviving parent and or the spouse, and sometimes don't deal with their own grief. So we do stuff for those siblings as well. And then we have the fiancés and significant others, and we have extended family. And we just have the different survivor groups that we do something for each one. The teenagers is one we just finished. And it was we did the young adults camp, which we did at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center in Charleston. We were able to bring teenagers, about 15 to 20, from across the country, and they got to see a glimpse into what their officer parent did before they died. And so they did demonstrations for those kids of different law enforcement tactics and different aspects of law enforcement. And then they also had that opportunity for that peer support and their counseling.
That's an amazing array of activities and services. I mean, I guess my question is, this has got to be tremendously expensive to keep these kind of operations running.
It is. We have about a $3 million budget per year that we operate on, and we're also always very careful to live within our means. Obviously, we rely about half of our budget comes straight from donations. We have a lot of law enforcement agencies that will organize fundraisers for us. We have a lot of corporate sponsors. We're always looking for more because our services are forever growing. About half of our budget comes from a grant from the federal government through the Department of Justice. And, you know, that's a grant that we apply for. Every couple of years we apply for that grant in hopes that we can keep all of our services going.
One thing that is for sure with the increasing number of law enforcement line of duty deaths that we have seen, especially this year, I would imagine that, you know, it's, you're like pouring water into a glass, because the water's not coming out of the glass. It's just continuing to get more and more full. So basically your client load, if you want to put it that way, just grows. It never diminishes.
You know, that's true. It does grow much faster than it diminishes, for sure. We do have survivors that do get better. I mean, that's part of what our mission is. We have survivors that rebuild their lives, and many of them come back to help the new survivors. But it is forever growing, and months like July that we just experienced, it's overwhelming. It's overwhelming to, obviously, those families that have experienced the huge loss.
I want to concentrate on that for the moment. You know, we've seen 100% more line of duty murders in the law enforcement field just this year alone since last year, and that doesn't count the other line of duty deaths from the traffic accidents and from all the other threats that take place towards law enforcement. Is there a difference in the way that you approach the murders, line of duty murders, as opposed to the line of duty deaths, say from a traffic accident?
You know what? There is not. One of the things that we know is that when an officer is killed in the line of duty, regardless of how they're killed, there's still a surviving family that's mourning and losing, that are grieving for their officer.
Right.
And our role is to support all the families, and so we don't treat the families any different from cops' perspective. We are very cognizant that the officers died in very different ways, and so when it comes to the counseling approach at the retreats, we do separate our families into groups, just because that peer support seems to work better when we put families that have had similar losses together. So there is some of that, but overall, as an organization, we're there for all the family members of fallen police officers.
Has it been tremendously more challenging this month, given the tragedies in Dallas and also in Baton Rouge?
Oh, absolutely, it has been. I mean, obviously, our chapters that are responding, they're overloaded with the numbers, and it's unprecedented. We've not ever experienced anything like this, short of 9/11, many years ago.
Right.
We've not ever experienced anything like this. So yeah, it's overwhelming to us. It's also overwhelming to all the law enforcement survivors, the other recent ones and the ones from years ago, that are watching all this in the news, and they're seeing this, and they're recognizing that there's all these families that have went through what they have, and that's a trigger for them. And so we've been busy supporting those other law enforcement surviving families from across the country that now need a little bit of boost. They need a little bit of help because they're watching the profession that their officer loved being torn down. And it's very challenging to them to watch other new survivors going through what they had to go through.
You know, you bring up a really interesting topic that I wanted to ask you about. So since Ferguson, and I mean, you were a Missouri police officer.
I was 2 hours away from there, yes.
Chief Tom Jackson was a guest on this show about a month ago. Very very interesting perspective that he had. But my question is this: we have seen the profession denigrated in ways that I would have thought impossible by the media, by groups like the activist groups that are sowing that anti-police message about, you know, we're out there murdering people just for the sake of doing it. Has that denigration of the profession, have you seen it have an effect on the survivors of the previous survivors of law enforcement?
Oh, absolutely, I have. And, you know, it has an effect on anybody that has, you know, that law enforcement culture in their blood. And these survivors all do. You know, they either married into the profession, or some of them are also law enforcement officers, or just through the interaction they had with their loved ones, they know how important law enforcement is and the role is. They really understand the backstory that some of, there are folks that aren't involved in law enforcement may not quite understand. They recognize that these are real people that are doing this job. They're generally good people because they do it out of the goodness of their heart, because they want to help people. They really do. And they see those people that were their loved ones that are now gone and died in support of this nation. And now it seems like the nation is somewhat turning on law enforcement, which then pays a little bit of disrespect to their loved ones. And it's very hard and scary for them to watch that. So there's a lot of support needed for those families and for any law enforcement. Even the, you know, we're talking about surviving families here, but my husband is a police officer. It's hard for me to watch him walk out the door to go to work right now. And, right, and there's right. many police wives and police husbands that are experiencing that same, we're rattled. You know, law enforcement is a little bit rattled right now. And I know, because I've been around a long time, that there's still a majority of the public that supports law enforcement, and I firmly believe that. But unfortunately, I think that that vocal minority that are causing, well, they've caused a lot of deaths, and they're causing, you know, this rhetoric. They're doing a lot of damage, and it's very painful to watch.
So, you know, when I didn't even think about it until we had this conversation about how those are the survivors from the past are in essence additional victims of all of this anti-police rhetoric and how that affects them psychologically. And it's that's a particularly poignant, I think, point of view that is not discussed at all and is not even thought about in the media and in the minds and hearts of the public.
Absolutely. Their officers died heroes. And now that whole hero is being questioned a little bit, and it's, I don't know if it's being questioned, but it's being downplayed and it's being attacked. And that's so painful for them to see that, because, you know, it's one of the ways that they adapt is they recognize that their spouse or their dad or their son died for the greater public good. And then when the public doesn't seem as appreciative, or is actually, some are going out and attacking new officers, it's incredibly difficult.
Right. You know, each year is National Police Week comes along in May, and that is the time when law enforcement officers from all over the world descend on Washington and visit the memorial, the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial, and honor all of the police officers who have given their lives. And of course, I've been there many, many times working with the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund. And is that particular week, that has to be a tremendously emotional time and a busy time for your organization.
Absolutely. Our role in National Police Week is we chair the committee that organizes how we get the law enforcement survivors from the different events at National Police Week, as well as offering our own events for them at National Police Week. So, for example, this year we had 3,300 survivors from across the country that came to Police Week in May, and we arranged for their hotel stays, we arranged for their transportation to go down to the Memorial Wall, which is such a wonderful tribute to their officers, and we arranged for them to go to the Candlelight Vigil and to the memorial service and the other events in D.C., as well as starting that process of putting them together with other people that have been through a similar experience. And that's where it really starts with cops for a lot of them, as they first see what we can do for them as far as helping them through that very difficult week, which is so emotional that many of them a year later don't even remember key parts of that week.
Right.
Absolutely.
You know, when I look back on my career, and I've spent 34 years as a police officer, and 15 of those I was the assistant commander of the Las Vegas Police Department Honor Guard. And of all of the memories that I have, one of the proudest moments of my life was when I was chosen to sing the national anthem at the memorial. And I'll never forget gazing down onto the faces of those survivors and realized that I was singing for them. And it was one of those moments that I even remembering it now, mm-hmm. still brings those emotions to the forefront. So I admire what you and your organization do, and the you know, the emotional toll it must take upon you as well, and the people that that work for you. You know, you especially after a law enforcement career as long as yours was, and you know, working the streets as well as in the administration, I think that I don't think that there could be a better person for the job than you. And I appreciate your taking that job and running with it, Ben, from the very, very capable Susie Sawyer, who gave birth to that organization. That's really a tremendous line of descent, if you will.
Oh, and nobody will ever fill Susie's shoes. She's an amazing individual, and she's the heartbeat of this organization, and she always will be, and she's still so involved in it. But, you know, just watching you with the emotion that you have here and you talking about how it does take a toll, is it absolutely does. And, you know, one of the things that we remind our survivors, and I'll remind you, and I'll remind the other coworkers that have lost a friend in the line of duty, is that, you know, your coworker that lost, you know, you lost in the line of duty, they're going to want you to be okay. You know, they're going to want you to, you know, work through this and be okay. And so we always tell people that it is absolutely okay to grieve, and we encourage you to grieve, and we're going to help you work through that grief. But we're going to also talk about rebuilding and going forward, and it is possible, and there is hope, and there's hope in this country, even as ugly as it seems like it is right now. And trust me, tears are always about to come out of my eyes too. And as ugly as it is, there is hope, because there are good people, and there are still people that are willing to put on that uniform and that badge and go out and protect people that maybe don't deserve to be protected, but they will be protected anyway, because that's what we do. And, you know, as long as there's still good men and women that are willing to do that, our country's going to be okay. You know, we need some strong leadership to get us through this right now. We really do. It's so hard to watch the profession that I love, and that you obviously love, being pulled through this. And it's hard on so many levels, but we need some leadership, and we need to get through it, but we will. And I firmly believe that we will, because you know what? Good does prevail over evil, and good will prevail over evil.
I couldn't agree more. And I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that I have found as a police activist and commentator for law enforcement in all over the country is I believe that their pendulum is starting to swing, in that I've never seen so many police support groups. I'm the national spokesman for Blue Lives Matter, and we topped over a million followers, likes, in just this last week. Now, that would have been unheard of 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
So I think that, you know, what we're seeing is there are, I believe, as you do, that most Americans truly do support their law enforcement officers and believe in them, but they aren't going to be vocal about it. But this is what we're seeing in the country. I believe we are seeing that pendulum begin to swing back towards supporting law enforcement.
Yeah, and I think even those that maybe have a legitimate complaint about a particular law enforcement officer or an agency, I think even most of those are appalled by what's going on. The majority of them are appalled by what's going on there. And so I completely agree. And we're getting phone calls left and right about people that will want to organize a fundraiser to help us keep our services going. And so we're feeling that support as well. And it really means a lot to us to know that there are those people that are still willing to help those families that are now trying to pick up their pieces.
That's fantastic. How can, as we come we're coming down to the end of our program here, how can people support Concerns of Police Survivors? Is there a website? Is there a way to donate?
Absolutely. Our website is nationalcops.org. It's just nationalcops.org. And we have a Facebook page as well. If you just search for National Cops, and then there's also an app that you can download that has all of our different services and ways that you can get involved, or your law enforcement agency can get involved. We're very lucky to enjoy the support of law enforcement across the country, and we appreciate everybody so much. I just want to make sure I put that message out there, because we know we couldn't do what we do without law enforcement.
And on that note, I want you to know this, that in all the time that I was, especially on the honor guard, you know, where I buried many of my friends, your organization is seen as one of the stellar organizations that is absolutely essential to helping the law enforcement mission.
Well, thank you very much for that. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, on the America Out Loud Network. And you have all my best wishes, my support, and the support of my listeners.
All right. Thank you very much, Randy.
This is Police Story, the real stories from those behind the badge.
Welcome to the Police Story segment of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement. As you know, each show I do a story that has been written by a police officer, a former law enforcement officer, or retired. And if you have a story that you would like to share, please send it to Randy Sutton at America Out Loud. This story is taken from, this is one of my own stories, and it's from my book, A Cop's Life. And it begins with the journey. The steel bars of the county jail slammed shut behind me with their customary cheerless finality as I trudged back to my patrol car. The 23-year-old tweaked-out stripper I had just booked on a narcotics charge was my third arrest of the shift. When she had learned that her impressive display of silicone accoutrements were not going to keep me from charging her with a felony dope rap, she had let loose with a well-aimed phlegm missile, and now I felt like steam cleaning my face. All I wanted to do was grab a cup of hot coffee, head back to the station, park myself in an office, finish my paperwork, and stop for a couple of beers on the way home. The blazing afternoon sun stabbed into my eyes as I crawled along with traffic, impatiently drumming my fingers against the steering wheel. I looked at my face in the rearview mirror. My cheek was abraded where I had wiped off the wad of spittle. Getting spat at was one of my least favorite forms of nonverbal communication, and I had reined myself in from bitch-slapping her. It was a fitting end to another lousy day. I had every intention of putting on the blinders that every cop keeps handy when he doesn't want to get involved with people. I felt the cumulative effect of 20 years of pushing a black and white around a sweltering city while being a frontline witness to the carnage, greed, and general nastiness that the people we try our damnedest to serve and protect engage in on a daily basis. I was counting down the days until my pension liberated me from the job I had once been so proud of. Now I was just like the inmates in the county jail, counting down the days to my release. Sitting there in traffic, I wondered what had happened to me. The things that had once given me simple joy and pleasure now failed to even pique my interest. The words of my last longtime girlfriend echoed in my head. She had packed up and moved out while I was working, leaving a note scotch taped to the bathroom mirror. It presented a detailed list of all my failings and ended by saying that I was, quote, untouchable, unquote. Well, maybe she was right. I didn't care enough about her note to even rip it off the mirror and ball it up or burn it or even preserve it as some poignant memento of lost love. I just pulled it off the glass so that I could see my face in the mirror and dropped it idly in the trash. That was nearly a year ago, and I hardly thought about her at all since. There was a coffee shop just up the road in the blue-collar neighborhood that I was driving through. I'd get a cup of coffee, use their bathroom to scrub my face one more time. I was about to turn down a side street when I saw her, a little girl, about 8, walking alone. It triggered a memory, a little girl's broken body in a dumpster, small, rigid fingers clutching a stuffed teddy bear. Her hooded eyes were wide open, lifeless, and dull, but staring straight through the young police officer I once was. I have long forgotten the details of the crime, but the murdered little girl's image has made guest appearances in my dreams for many years. The little girl, the living one, was standing patiently on the corner just up ahead, waiting to cross the street, while the never-ending river of cars flowed by. As I drove closer, I could see her more clearly. She didn't resemble the girl in the dumpster at all, except that she too was young and black. She had a milk chocolate complexion, and her long dark hair had been pulled tightly into a ponytail cascading down her thin back. She was wearing what looked like the white blouse and plaid skirt of a school uniform. Despite the chill in the October air, she wasn't wearing a jacket. She carried nothing with her but an air of perfect innocence. She looked up and down the street as she patiently waited for her chance to cross. Without even thinking about what I was doing, I drove close to the corner and slowed to a stop, flicking on the overhead light bar of my unit to stop the traffic behind me. I wanted to give her the chance to cross, but she didn't step off the curb. For a moment, she looked pensively around the wide intersection and then Her big eyes met mine. I got out of the patrol car and walked over to her, aware of the stares of the rush hour commuters stopped behind me and of those passing from the opposite direction. "May I walk you across the street?" I asked, taking off my sunglasses and leaning down so she could look me directly in the eyes. She nodded shyly and reached out her hand as if we had crossed 100 streets together. I took her small hand in mine and felt its warmth. "My mommy always said that a policeman would help me," she whispered in a soft voice with a southern lilt, and her face lit up with a smile so pure and genuine that I felt something stir within me. She looked up at me and we swung our arms slightly as we began our journey. It was a magic moment. All the cars on the street and all four corners of the intersection slowed and stopped to watch our progress. Drivers, instead of being angry at the delay, were mesmerized by the sight of the uniformed cop walking hand in hand across the street with a little girl. I saw smiles on the faces of some that earlier I would have cynically pegged as suspects on a parole violators. I felt something I hadn't felt in a long time. I actually felt good inside. Our journey ended much too quickly as we stepped up onto the far curb and I released her little hand. "Thank you, officer," she said, and gave me another incredible smile. Then she did something that so surprised me that I couldn't even react for a moment. She stood up on her tiptoes and threw her thin arms around my neck and hugged me. "I love you, officer," she whispered with her soft cheek next to mine. There was no trace of anything in her tone but a little girl's truth. I hugged her back hesitantly and quickly let her go. I watched her for a moment as she walked away, then turned back towards my patrol car. I noticed that the traffic still wasn't moving, that the occupants of the stopped cars were all smiling, as if the image of the cop and the little girl had touched them in some way. In that moment, as I stepped off the curb, I remembered why I had become a cop.
End of watch.
Each week on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we have a segment called End of Watch, where we memorialize the law enforcement officers who have died in the line of duty during that week. Today we have three. From Travis County, Sergeant Craig Hutchinson of the Travis County Sheriff's Office was shot and killed when he interrupted a burglary in progress as he arrived home in Round Rock at the end of his shift, approximately 1:20 a.m. Sergeant Hutchinson was still in uniform, contacted dispatchers via radio, and reported that several subjects were running in his backyard. Responding deputies located Deputy Hutchinson suffering from a fatal gunshot in the yard as they arrived approximately 10 minutes later. The subjects fled the area and remain at large. He served with the Travis County Sheriff's Office for 32 years and was scheduled to retire in just 2 months. Captain David Melton was shot and killed while searching for an armed robbery subject who had fled from other officers who had responded to a shots fired call at approximately 2 p.m. He served with the Kansas City, Kansas Police Department for 17 years. Previously, he had served with the Wyandotte County Sheriff's Office for 9 years. He was also a veteran of the Kansas National Guard. As officers arrived on the scene, several subjects exited the vehicle they were in, fled on foot. One of the men was apprehended immediately. Officers began searching the area for the other subjects. Captain Melton was fatally shot when he encountered one of the men near the intersection of 22nd Street and Haskell Avenue. The third law enforcement officer to die in the line of duty was Correctional Officer Christopher Moles of the Luzerne County Correctional Facility in Pennsylvania. The 25-year-old correctional officer died after he and an inmate fell down an elevator shaft during a struggle inside the Luzerne County Correctional Facility. The inmate, who was in jail for failing to register as a sex offender, attacked Officer Moles. The two crashed through an elevator door and fell several floors to the bottom of the elevator shaft. He was transported to the local hospital where he was pronounced dead. He'd only served for 10 months. This is their end of watch. This concludes this week's episode of Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, with your host, Randy Sutton, on the America Out Loud Network. I welcome your comments. Please feel free to contact me at randysutton@americaoutloud.com. We have an app now, believe it or not. I know I'm not the technology wizard, but America Out Loud has now created an app. Just go to your app store and grab it, as well as subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. And feel free to contact me, randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Remember, if you have a story and you're a retired cop or a current serving one, and you want to have that story read on the air, please submit it to me, randysutton@americaoutloud.com. Once again, I thank you for listening. I thank you for tuning in. Stay safe. And remember this, blue lives matter.